Welcome, friends, to another episode of Talking Strategy and Making History. I'm Dick Flax. I'm going to be joined by my partner in crime, Daraka Larimore-Hall. We'll be talking again, as we have in the past, to the distinguished dean of American labor historians, Nelson Lichtenstein. Nelson has a new book co-authored with Samir Santi, actually co-edited. It's an anthology of articles from Dissent magazine about the labor movement from the 1950s to today. The title of the book is Labor's Partisans. We're going to use this book as a kind of springboard for a discussion about not only labor's past, but the state of the unions today in relation to the struggle against authoritarianism, against the Trump agenda, and what are the prospects given all kinds of challenges, but also a rising tide of interest in organizing among a lot of young working people in this country. So stick with us for, I think, a provocative and useful conversation in these times. Welcome, Nelson Lichtenstein, back to Talking Strategy, Making History. It's always a pleasure to have you, your wisdom. And in particular, we're going to talk about a new book project that recently got published and use that as a springboard, as we always do, to talk about the state of the unions in the midst of the state of the union. Welcome, Nelson.
Good to be here.
And hi to you, Daraka. So Labor's Partisans is the name of this book, just recently published by the New Press. And it's a compilation, which is not always that newsworthy, but I personally think it is quite a newsworthy piece because of what you put together here. It's a compilation of material spanning the history of a magazine called Dissent, which I grew up with and you grew up with, but which many people may not know that much about. So what is Dissent magazine anyway?
Well, it's been in existence for more than 70 years, founded in 1954. It was called itself a socialist magazine. The editor, Irving Howe, famous figure in American thought and letters, said, socialism is the name of our desire. Now, when they founded it in the middle of the 50s, this was not a radical period, but they viewed themselves as, you know, kind of holding on, holding out the ideal of that, of the socialist idea. They really didn't. Maurice Isserman once, a very good historian, described them as sort of tired radicals. That's not quite right. But they were a little bit disenchanted in the sense of the revolutionary radical hopes of the 30s and 40s that had passed. But they still wanted to say we need a group of intellectuals, group of people, group of writers. Actually, many people were not. They had auto workers and steel workers writing for them. It wasn't as if they were all New York intellectuals, although a lot of them were, to hold on to the socialist idea in a period of great conservatism. Now they were, of course, a particular kind of radical. They were the non-communist sort of came out of a sort of Trotskyist world, but that broadened and became more of a. That was the origins, but as the magazine went on, that particular kind of politics was there, but it became part of other strands that went into it. So 70 years is a long time for a magazine, and they consistently covered the labor movement from the beginning. And the book came into existence because one of their longtime supporters and writers, Jules Bernstein, had some money, and he said, "Let's put out a book, which covers the labor reportage from Dissent, of which many famous people wrote for Dissent, Daniel Bell and Harvey Suedos and Dwight McDonald and Norman Mailer and all sorts of people. And anyway, when they were writing about labor, so put it together. So with actually Samir Santi, who I'm very happy to say was got his PhD here at the University of California, Santa Barbara, was my co-editor. And we had a very, you know, we had fun going through all of the thousands of articles, I guess, that have appeared in 70 years. We're not all on labor, but we went and tried to pick out some representative ones, which we published.
Well, and the list of names in the table of contents is impressive just from a labor history, the kinds of figures who are in there. But you've got, in addition to names you mentioned, Michael Harrington, for example. Yeah, I just make one comment. I remember vividly to this day an article in Dissent that's in this book by Harvey Suedos about the auto workers. It influenced my thinking deeply, and maybe we'll get into some of that as we go along. But there are many other. I wrote for Dissent, and I knew Michael Harrington. I knew a bit of Irving Howe. I knew Louis Kozer was the co-editor, and I was finally happy that they did give some recognition, but it was quite a struggle to the New Left and the Students for Democratic Society. But that's all history. I don't want to dwell on it. Daraka, you've been using this book in a class on labor history. You taught this quarter, right?
Quarter's not quite over, but my labor studies seminar course has been using this as kind of our main textbook. And it's been really helpful because, the way that the book is organized in, chronological order, but also thematically around some of the big questions that face the labor movement, in terms of the creation of the post-war order, the stagnation of it, and then its destruction. And then, importantly, some recent articles about, the new economy and the post-new economy and what it means for workers and what it means for organizing. So it's actually, it's been a very useful text.
Yeah, I mean, normally I wouldn't do this, but I think this might be useful to your listeners. Here are the main five divisions of the book. One is called Socialist Look to the Post-War Labor Movement. That was the original group of socialists who founded Dissent. What did they think of the labor movement? That was one. We have several articles from that. And then the next one is Democracy in American Trade Unions with a question mark, because that was a big issue back to then and today. And there was a kind of a debate about that, how important democracy was for, effective trade unionism. Some people thought, unions are fighting capital. So whether they're internally democratic or not may not be that important. And then another one, of course, on a time of troubles, which is all about the 70s and 80s and the difficulties of that period, the 90s. And then we have last two, two new frontiers, new kinds of people who are being organized. And then, of course, since this is about a socialist magazine, the last section is called What is to be done, right? That's of course.
There's a little kind of symposium at the end. Was that from the magazine, or did you create that?
No, we created that. We created that.
Mention that, because that's
we had Sarah Nelson, who was the rather well-known head of the flight attendants, and Luis Leon, who's an editor of Labor Notes, someone very good, and Daisy Pitkin, who has written a very good, very good book about organizing. And they were, here's where, it was this discussion took place, I think, in May of 2024, and what were the prospects, and what I don't think they disagreed in any dramatic way, but it was sort of like, what are the prospects for the future here? And obviously the moment for this book coming out, it's not an accident that it comes out now, is a kind of at least a revival of the interest in unionism by a new generation. Whether the numbers growing, is another question of the actual potency of the unions. But certainly there's no doubt, and here I asked Daraka whether he found this among his students, that there's a new interest in the idea of unionism. And I think that's that discussion and all of the last part of the book is really based on that, what's been happening in the last couple of years here.
Well, there certainly is an interest. I mean, I think you can see it statistically and then, anecdotally. My students are, of course, the most unscientific end possible. I teach labor studies. So it's a self-selecting group. But from how they talk about their peers in talking to students who take, my kind of more general courses and so forth, there is not just an interest in unions, unionization, but in particular in trying to find career paths that are allied with or in the labor movement, which is very interesting. And then, the other thing that I've found, quite refreshing is how much openness and kind of voracious hunger there is for learning about labor history, activist history, the history of the left, much more than students were, I think, like a decade ago, which is made teaching this book also really interesting. A couple of notes. One thing is that how, I don't know if it was by design or a happy accident, but the very first section, which is like ostensibly the oldest, the oldest essays, addressing issues the furthest from us, I thought were all incredibly relevant. You know, there's this essay about automation that my students instantly picked up on as describing what's going on now with AI and other, you know, introductions of different technologies into the workplace. But also even the essay by Harrington about who the working class is, the old working class and the new working class. And, all you know, it really is a very well put together set of essays, not just as a set of historical documents for the sake of documenting interesting, fascinating history, but also as like a reader on, you know, just core questions confronting organizing working people or working people trying to get political power, et cetera. So really can't recommend it enough. Should be on all the bookshelves, as they say.
You know, Dirac, the one thing that I was sort of struck by, and I kind of, maybe kind of surprised a bit in going over all the, you know, finding, looking, reading all these sent essays, that in the 50s, when the union movement was strong and big and we think of it as successful, and in a way, we'd like to get back to that. I know during the recent strike of graduate students at UC, all the UC campuses, one of their major demands was, we want COLA, cost of living adjustment. I thought, well, that's exactly what the unions were demanding and getting in 1955, but anyway, I was struck by the degree to which the writers for Dissent were critical of the union movement. Sidney Lenz, great Chicago radical, I guess he was sort of Irving House, said, write something about the AFL and the CIO merging. And he was very critical of it. He thought, oh, it's just, you know, becoming more bureaucratic and more closely tied to the Democrats. Or the famous, you're right, Dick, the Harvey Suedos essay is called, the title of it is The UAW, Over the Top or Over the Hill, you know, and he was very critical. He wrote this in the early 60s when the UAW was absolutely at its height of power and was winning things and was politically influential. And, you know, and he said, well, they've reduced their aspirations. What happened to the stars that used to be in the eyes of all the UAW radicals? They've sort of made their peace with the status quo a bit. So I was very surprised at that. And then you move forward a generation, although the unions are weaker and sometimes they're even more conservative, but the writers in the magazine are certainly by the 80s, late 70s, 80s, 90s are, you know, the union movement's on, we got to link our solidarity with the unions, no matter how, whatever problems they have, we're going to be, you know.
Well,
it's
a story of the American left, but just like a slightly different trajectory than the new left, but still one of, hoping for more at the height of the New Deal order, and critiquing it from the left, and then mourning its loss after, Reagan.
Yeah.
Well, I think the thing that I remember about the Suedos article that hit me very hard, this is 60 years ago that I read it, was that because I was in Ann Arbor, and we had a lot of relations, we in the early New Left, with the sons and daughters of UAW leaders, for example. Yeah. And we knew some of those leaders. And he basically says what the union, UAW had achieved were contracts, that five-year term contracts that provided cost of living increases, that provided wages, that enabled many workers to actually buy their own homes. It was unbelievable in terms of the material gain. But something was really traded for that. Namely, the union gave up efforts to control the workplace itself, the working conditions on the job, and that on a day-to-day level made the job and the life of the worker no better than it had been. And that's what I remember about that, because I thought that was a fascinating point. And then I've told you this story, Nelson, of being at the UAW convention shortly after that and hearing from the floor, union stewards speaking from the floor about this very fact that they were presiding over a great deal of member discontent over the working conditions, and the union was not addressing those kinds of things. So I don't know. That seems to me, at that time, people were conscious of this as a trade-off. Now, I'm not sure that there's any hope day-to-day on the part of a lot of workers that they're going to be able to really... Well, how does that issue play out now?
There's a very good essay by B.J. Wittig, who is an auto worker and an old radical, and later, you know, from Ann Arbor, and he worked for, he was in the Chrysler plants for 20 years, and he has a very good essay precisely about the working conditions, etc. I would put it a little differently, and actually here I disagree with kind of a general, that's so-called trade-off. The way I would put it would be that trade-off means you give one thing and you get something else. Well, basically, in the 30s and 40s, the UAW is defeated when it comes to the question of any kind of control of, you know, working conditions. They try very hard, both formally and in wildcat strikes and et cetera, et cetera. They are defeated. It's a defeat. Now, they are not defeated, and in part because the companies are making money and it's a different political moment, they are not defeated in actually raising the standard of living of American workers. But they wanted both. And you can both, everything from shop stewards to Walter Reuther's speeches, they want both. In 1964, Reuther denounces the gold-plated sweatshops, etc. And I would make this point. The famous Dodge Revolutionary Union movement that comes along in the late 69, 70, actually what they were demanding was precisely the same thing that UAW radicals and activists were demanding in 1939 and 1940, that is, right, control of production, shop stewards that were as powerful as foremen, et cetera. So that thing of trade-off, I don't buy that. There's a defeat, yeah, and on one level, and which from the point of view of the auto companies is more important, because they can give higher wages and then raise the price of cars, et cetera, et cetera. But so I would put it that way.
Yeah, and we had about 10 or 15 years where the American auto industry was globally dominant, and right, where therefore the cost of wage benefits and health benefits and so forth could be incorporated into the price of the cars. And then along come Japanese and German competition, right, and that changed everything for America, really. Anyway, I don't know that we want to dwell so much on the history, although the history is both fascinating in itself, and of course, as the Rocha's students are saying, still bears very much on what we're trying to deal with today, including the UAW. I mean, that's a big thread in this book. You've spent a good deal of your life trying to understand the UAW, Nelson Lichtenstein. And now the new president of UAW, for the first time, it's a Democratic union in terms of the election of the president. And we have Sean Fain as a result. So what's the latest feelings you have about that particular story?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that just on the UA, that the writers for Dissent, the first generation certainly, and probably the second and third generations, they always viewed the UAW as the key union. Maybe one could say that cause that's a mistake in the last 30 or 40 years, that there are other, you know, the SEIU and hospital workers and teachers, sure, but they always did view the UAW as particularly important. Well, of course, what's happened, two things, good and bad, dark and light in the last 2 years. On the one hand, and the UAW did elect a new leadership. Sean Fain is unquestionably a skillful and rhetorically skillful and almost charismatic figure, which democratically elected and in many ways. And I shouldn't even focus on him. I think the whole whole strata of UAW activists and people have re-energized that union, and they did conduct a really brilliant strike in 2023, which was quite successful, and not just in terms of what the UAW won, but instantly after they won that the strike, all of the non-union companies in the auto industry instantly raised wages to the same level of the UAW. This is extremely important and new because for decades before this, it was really the non-union companies that were sort of setting the pace, and the unionized firms had to follow that or kind of follow that. But here in this case, it was very clear that the Toyotas and Nissans and non-union companies, and even Tesla, they instantly raised wages. Now, that's the good thing. The bad thing is, the dark thing is, the UAW thought it could instantly, it could very quickly organize these non-union companies in the South, and they had a lot of wind at their back. The government was providing money for battery plants and other plants. The companies clearly in the South, we know that the workers at these companies were excited about the prospect of unionization. But this has not happened. And they even had a brilliant victory at Volkswagen. They won 73% of the vote in April of 2024, which is a remarkable, tremendous victory. But they haven't gotten a contract in the 13 months since that. So, and I would say this is the case with the entire pro-union a sense of organizing and et cetera that's gone on, whether it's Starbucks or other places. Yes, the union, the workers are voting for the union, in one way or another, and showing their support. But companies, are hanging tough, and they're succeeding in hanging tough. I mean, and that's why union density continues to decline, even in this moment, putting Trump aside. So that is the dark side of it. And, there's some things we can do about that, but that's a reality that we have to face.
What is it that allows a company to hang tough, even though we have allegedly a legal system that supports collective bargaining?
Well, right, but that legal system has one kind of many fatal flaws, and one of which is that there's no penalties for failing to bargain. You have a duty to bargain, but there's no. And the other thing, and I have to think, I say this. I went to Chattanooga. I spoke with some of the leading activists. I think only about 5 months after the election, 4 months, 5 months after the election, and they told me that. Consciousness is episodic. It's episodic. And even 4 or 5 months after this election, they, for example, did not think they could organize a strike. I mean, in the 30s and 40s, if the management wasn't bargaining, you had a strike. And today, at least in Volkswagen, they didn't think they could have a successful strike, or that would also be the case in some other places. And at Starbucks, where they have had strikes, but there the problem is, yes, you have 500 coffee shops that are organized, but there are 9,500 that aren't. So a strike, doesn't have the impact it might have had. So this is a problem that needs to be confronted here. And I think, a certain kind of ebullient optimism, that's always a good thing. But I think there's a reality here. We have to figure out what to do about it.
Part of the problem, obviously, is just getting workers to the point of bargaining and getting organized and getting those unions certified. And the other book that I'm actually using in that same course, We Are the Union by Eric Blanc, I know has kick-started some good discussions amongst labor organizers, leaders, activists, scholars, et cetera. And we had him on our podcast. What do you make of his analysis or his proposal that, we have to get better at fostering the ability of workers to, at least get started with the process on their own or with a limited support from, paid staff and the more resource intensive parts of
the labor movement. He says many things that are very intelligent and correct. For example, he makes the point that the unions haven't been spending enough money organizing, that even if they did a so-called staff-driven union, you wouldn't have enough money to turn the tide. His key theme is worker to worker organizing, which clearly was the case at Starbucks and many of these decentralized retail places. I mean, I totally agree with that, and I think he's also making the larger point. And this is here we get kind of that there are no longer any actually strategic kind of workplaces, you know, as in, you know, Chevy Ford in 1937, where if you shut that down, you shut the entire General Motors down, or you know, some crucial U.S. Steel or something. Whereas today, and it's, you know, think of, you know, retail, the thousands of outlets, you know, you think of the fissured workplaces all over the country, that it's sort of decentralized. And therefore, there's no one place that's going to be the kind of the node of the crucial. And therefore, you need this worker-to-worker organizing as a way of spreading the message and spreading the movement. And I think now there's a lot of truth to that. However, as, for example, looking at Amazon and any other logistics company, there are, in fact, still crucial places. If you're thinking about the West Coast docks, where the ILWU, although a small union, it is an effective union, and boy, it can do a lot, you know, in shutting down, you know, American capitalism, if it chooses to do so. And the same would be true of the of all the Amazon distribution centers. And Amazon is now a kind of whole ecology of you know, a whole new world, but there are strategic places. So there's been a kind of debate that, you know, the union movement can't give up the idea of really of the command. Where are the commanding heights of American capitalism? And in the 30s, and as Eric Block makes the point that in his book, that, you know, that was what was organized. And so today, what are the commanding heights? I know that Jane Slaughter, who is a person I respect a great deal, she's been a writer for Labor Notes for decades and decades. She said something like, well, it's great that Starbucks, you know, that we have these wonderful young people at Starbucks who are organizing and going, but in the end, it's still a coffee shop. You know, that's not quite the same thing as Silicon Valley or Port of Los Angeles, you know. So anyway,
But why is that so important? I understand, like, the term commanding heights, to me, that's a term that was important for people deciding what industries to nationalize, to steer the economy. And I guess if you're thinking about, what group of workers can ask for the highest wages so that it causes compaction across the economy so everyone gets raises, that's why it's important to think about the strategy. Because it's not like the labor movement is contemplating a general strike to overthrow the government and therefore needs to think about how do you stop capitalism. So I guess I don't really understand what the stakes are of that strategically, what the real stakes are beyond a kind of esoteric.
Yeah, no, I would say fantasy. It was true 50, 60 years ago, and I think it's still true today, that some very successful big companies do set the standard. They set the standard, and then retail, it's a Walmart or an Amazon or a Home Depot. They set the standard, the social wage standard. And what companies are most important are doing that has changed. It used to be General Motors and U.S. Steel. Now it's a Silicon Valley, obviously, that's one thing. But then, the retail, big retailers on the other. And I think that if you...
So then
you
wouldn't that be Starbucks and Amazon and these places?
I think Starbucks would be. It is big enough that it would have. If they did have a kind of an agreement there and the wages went up 50 or 60%, I think that would have a huge impact throughout the entire retail.
Yeah, if I could go get a job at Starbucks for 20 bucks an hour, then... There's so many employers that are competing with Starbucks for employees that I would think that would have an impact.
By the way, here's something that I'm in favor of, although this is maybe controversial. There's something called sectorial bargaining, which actually was invented in the progressive era. At the time, it was thought that, women and children and, you know, working in the garments or retail, they really can't have real unions. So the state would kind of be a player in a kind of corporatist or kind of a, you'd have the state, you'd have the unions, you'd have the employers, they get together and they'd sort of set a wage really for, you know, whatever it was, department stores or something. Now, that idea has come back. Mm-hmm. We have that it works very well now in professional sports. I mean, you know, the baseball players don't just bargain with the Yankees. They bargain with, you know, the entire league. That's sectorial bargaining. And then recently, we had in California, we have a fast food law where, McDonald's is today paying $22 an hour in California. That's substantial. Now, there's no union there. I mean, or at least no one, maybe no one working in McDonald's thinks of themselves, or they aren't part of a union. That's a problem. That's for if you're thinking about democracy and worker empowerment and consciousness. But nevertheless, they're making $22 an hour, and that's a sort of new wage standard that's being set in California for other people who are not under that sectorial bargaining.
Yeah, there's sort of lots of examples of.
Yeah, I mean, again,
industry.
Some people don't like that because that idea, because you don't have a union. You know, there's a virtue in having people coming together and thinking together and democratically deciding things. I mean, that's democracy, and that's important. Unions are not just about raising wages; they're about all sorts of other things. But you don't have that with under sectorial bargaining, I grant. Well,
so that's a very interesting dilemma here, which is that it's possible, in a sense, politically to raise wages in certain sectors by action of local city councils, for example, as well as the state law that you mentioned in California. Yeah. These are things that groups, unions like SEIU, I guess, have been working for that kind of avenue rather than collective bargaining in the usual meaning of workers being organized. You're saying it's more of a political decision governmental control, and that's the Eric Blank view is, look, there's this tremendously growing feeling of worker to worker consciousness and wanting to be organized, and he's groping, isn't he, a little bit to let's redefine what the unions are about. If they can't come to the table for collective bargaining, there's still ways to define gains and victories that maybe we should foreground. So when the non-unionized auto companies are raising wages to match what the UAWs achieve, that's a victory. It shouldn't be seen simply as a way of undercutting the union. It should be claimed as what we're trying to achieve through organizing. But, you know, I wonder how much we know about whether people in workplaces are discussing what should we do if we do get organized? What can we hope for? Maybe they have some ideas that we need to have a better sense of.
Let me make this point. This will sound quite conservative. Well, not conservative exactly, but it's old fashioned, that consciousness ebbs and flows. We are fortunate today to be at a moment when consciousness, you know, a pro-union sentiment among young people, for example, is on the rise. That's great. And what a legally binding contract or a law, for that matter, a civil rights law or a minimum wage law, for that matter, what that does is to crystallize and sort of institutionalize that level of consciousness. Now, later on, people can become apathetic and or whatnot, and you know, but nevertheless, there's that contract. But when you have that situation, then you think, oh, it's kind of, you know, it doesn't sound so exciting. But nevertheless, there's the contract, which is like a set of laws. And one of my favorite pamphlets the UAW put out years ago. They said, you know, a bright steward is like a lawyer. They can figure out how to make the contract work for the worker. Anyway, so that's something that I think the Wobblies were wrong. And maybe to the extent that Eric Blank is sort of a little bit overly enamored of this sort of worker to worker kind of just a sort of a kind of almost cultural social sense of engagement, that's all to the good. But the fact is that turnover certainly is enormous. That's one problem, where just people are leaving. So who's the next cohort a year and a half later on? So you know, that's why contracts are, you know, they aren't revolutions, but they're a good thing.
I don't think that's Eric's position. I think there is in fact like a part of the labor conversation that's like collective bargaining is passé. Independent unions, like, I mean, literally wobbly, you know, let's join the Wobblies. And that's, you know, Eric's always been very critical of that. Like, no, the point is to eventually get people into affiliated with like big, real unions. Yeah. It's what he's questioning, though, is like, how do you get people or offering, I think, some more traditionally radical, traditionally leftist, traditionally, you know, social movement oriented tactics for getting people into those first steps, which, I mean, frankly, makes sense because when we got big, the points in history where we got big, that was, you know, it was a movement dynamic on the ground, not a let me convince this worker why it's in their rational interest to sign a card, you know, and I have to get paid to do that 1,000 times a day sort of approach. But I agree with you 1,000% that like any strategy, which is the theme of our podcast, any strategy has to like account for periods of abeyance and doldrums and demobilization and, you know, less energy and all of those things that you describe. It has to like put things in place that keep people from being harmed and maybe even improves their conditions, even when we're not in a upswing of engagement. And that's I think, a very important difference between a democratic reformist kind of politics and a end of the world millenarian, we're going to fix the world in one fell swoop kind of politics. And
the Millerites, yeah.
Yeah. And no, why I love, you know, back to Dissent. Yeah. That's like why I've always loved that magazine. It's that.
Yeah, I stand corrected on the what Eric Block wants ultimately. Yeah, that's right. Right. You're right.
No, but you're right. There is, you're not wrong that there's a position out there that.
I think the way to resolve that, that Eric Blank question is say he's really looking for ways to define victory that are not simply bound by formal contract, but also have other, where you can point to gains and therefore keep people's morale going for organizing.
Yeah.
So here's the situation we're in now in this country, isn't it? That large groups of workers, federal workers, have been, their jobs have been either been terminated in some mysterious and seemingly illegal fashion, or they're very threatened. And that creates harm to them, but also to the wider society. And how is organized labor trying to respond, or are they trying to respond in that circumstance?
Well, I mean, they are obviously. I just was on the email with a person I know who's a federal worker. I mean, a union official, an official of federal workers, and obviously they asked me to put together a petition, which I did, for historians, saying that when unions are destroyed, this is clearly a step toward authoritarianism, and I mean, in a way, the destruction of the federal collective bargaining among federal workers is as great as the destruction of PATCO, or even more so. And, you know, I mean, now these federal unions, PATCO was interesting 40 years ago, more than that.
Tell us what PATCO was.
The Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, which was 11 or 12,000, you know, air traffic controllers who were becoming increasingly militant during the 1970s. Many of them were Air Force, ex-Air Force people and, you know, military people, but nevertheless, they're becoming increasingly militant and kind of militant, but they were also had a conservative side to them. They supported Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, they exactly. I was going to say they'd endorsed it.
He would help them out, but anyway, they struck in August of 1981, and their union was destroyed by the Reagan administration. Now that was a hugely symbolic, more than symbolic thing, which really set in train decades of union difficulties, defeat. Now, but today, collective bargaining has been abrogated for, I don't know, some 800,000 federal workers. And this has not gotten as much news as it should. Part of the reason for that is that these unions were constrained even in what they could do. They couldn't really bargain for higher wages. They couldn't go on strike. They were a bit tenuous, but nevertheless, Trump just abrogated the collective bargaining, and I mean, it's being challenged in the courts. But you know, if this kind of thing happens in one sector, it's going to happen, you know, other places as well. Starting probably with, you know, public employees in various states, and then, you know, moving on. So, you know, that's what conservatives, the sort of libertarian tinge conservative, they want to atomize the working class and really destroy any actual real organizations that they don't control completely. And there's a reason that unions are both the first institution that authoritarians destroy, going back from back to the from the you know the Mussolini and the Nazis and into onto Spain and other places. And Brazil. And also, when you get rid of an authoritarian, the unions are always, you know, part of that upsurge. And I think, you know, we should begin to look at it in that way today. And, you know, I mean, I think we're at a moment here where there is beginning a momentum among both unionists and others in resisting the authoritarian turn that's taking place from Washington.
What is specifically, I mean, we know that everyone's in court to contest all these things, and it seems to me that's the big crunch right now. It's being played out in the court system, but everyone is, you know, tremendously anxious. Can the Trumpers refuse to follow the courts if the courts ruled in their favor? And so we're at this crunch point. But is there a sort of grassroots action side of what people in the labor movement are talking about and coming forward?
Well, or even not even grassroots, but just union leaders. There are radical union leaders today. There are people who see themselves as leftists, from the CWA and the lawyer, and you know, to the UAW and etc. You know, who are kind of now Sean Fain's for a general strike beginning May 1st, 2028.
Me too.
We can't wait for that. We can't wait for that kind of thing to happen. I think, well, I would say this moment, the unions are not demoralized, at least as unions. The Chicago teachers just want a very good contract. There are other places that they're still kind of very, very kind of active. They aren't, you know, feeling in the way they were in the 80s, utterly defensive. So at least at that level, the unions that exist are feeling their oats a little bit. To a degree, and Bernie is once again leading the charge, and he said, sort of, not our fault. We weren't the ones who were in charge of the strategy of the Democrats. You know, this was really our opponents within the party who were the ones who failed in the fall of 2024. So, but Dick, your question is good, because although I'm hopeful something will gel in the near future, but at this very moment, I think you're right that it's not happening. Is that what your implication was?
Well, I'm wondering how so many people could be thrown out of work so quickly without they themselves as workers saying, what recourse do we have? What are we supposed to be doing? And I'm not sure what they're expecting. Do they really think, is it the court process that they're waiting for resolution of? Because there have been these cases where already courts have said, you can't fire this group of people and that group. And so there have been delays in some of this process. And incidentally, today's news is indicating that Elon Musk, who decided to go back to being a capitalist,
I don't buy it.
Is pretty disgusted. He's publicly disgusted with what's going on.
Yeah, his feelings are hurt, but I think he's just going to be doing it from the shadows.
I don't get. I really don't get this. How can an order come from an administration to simply shut down a whole category of federal government operation and fire all these people? It doesn't sound like a legal.
No, it's not. I mean, the ostensible rationale they're using is, national security. But most of the unions that they're actually destroying have nothing to do with it. Right. And they do with that. They're like the agriculture department or something. And so that's why it is illegal. But the reason we're facing an authoritarian turn is that the courts are ruling against this administration, but the administration is ignoring the courts. I mean, that is the definition of authoritarianism. And I would say, I would say that maybe one reason to explain the current passivity of these is in a way that, well, the courts are ruling in our favor. So it's only a matter of time before this thing is resolved.
But I don't even know that I would describe it as passivity. I mean, I think one thing is any of us need to always be humble about like what we're finding out about, because the flurry of news is so difficult to follow. But you know, there are a couple of journalists, labor journalists, who've been really tracking the resistance, the mobilizing, the mutual aid networks that have been forming amongst federal employees. But like, ultimately, they do need the courts. They need some part of the government to rehire them or bring them back or get them restitution, because it's not like they can just go in and occupy the USAID office and just keep working. And I'm kind of half joking when I say that, except that there was like an armed confrontation over this sort of thing, you know, when one part of the government didn't want to follow Doge's orders. And that is sort of like where we're at in a scary sense.
I'd certainly be in favor of federal employees occupying their, you know, sit-ins in their offices. I think that'd be a great
thing. Yeah, sit-in, absolutely. It just would be hard for them to like go about business as usual, you know, as a meat inspector or whatever. But but I do see, it does seem like people are getting involved and getting engaged who weren't before, because exactly as you said, Nelson, like these were the sleepiest of sleepy little unions in normal times, filing a couple grievances here and there and so forth. But now they're, like just like PATCO, radicalized by just being shit on.
Let's step back one moment to Sean Fain and the May Day general strike idea. And it is not really tied to Trump. It was something I think he was proposing even before all this, right? Explain what he seems to have in mind with that.
Yeah, he proposed very shortly after he was elected, I think even before the strike took place, that as many unions as possible coordinate their expiration dates for their contracts to May 1st or the day May 1st, 2028. And, you know, well, that you know, and there's a logic to that. That would be great. I think that, you know, a few unions are trying to do that. You know, it's exciting. I mean, here's a labor leader. I would say that there's a labor leader who's thinking ambitiously.
Yeah.
I think that's important because they've been defensive for so long. And, you know, even the rhetoric you have about, you know, oh, the oligarchs and, you know, which is, you know, Bernie does that and other labor leaders do that. But that's one kind of rhetoric. OK, but what about, you know, let's our empowerment, our, you know, the world that we want to create, you know. And I think that Sean Fain can do that. I think he's very good at deploying the social gospel that, you know, he is a Protestant. And I think he has that Debsian reading of the Bible, which I think is very good. So he made that proposal. Now, I have to say, I think that it's general strikes when they do happen in world history. They happen because of particular incidents. Usually, the government uses the police power to break or hurt the unions, and then in response to that, there's a general strike right away. You don't wait 3 years. So I'm in favor of it, but I don't see that as the solution to our problems.
Well, it depends on, wouldn't it depend to some extent on how much before the date there is agitation, so to speak, and education about what we can achieve if we all went on. That would really involve having a set of demands that people are building up around that really represent something transformative. I'm not sure what.
Well, when we have had real general strikes, and I would say the Red for Ed was a general strike of a sort. It had the character of that. You know, there's a kind of mobilization, but then there's a particular incident, a kind of a crisis, and then it takes place.
That's the point. Like that's the problem. Like you were saying, we're not articulating what we want, and this would be the idea is, for as far as I understand it, is like a strike in order to win things. So as opposed to defending from a take back or a repression. I don't know. I continue to be enamored of the idea.
All general strikes are illegal. They just are. but that in the end. I wrote a book, which is called Why Unions Matter. And the last chapter is about why we need general strikes. And I have four of them. One is San Francisco, 1934, where I describe that as a general strike and why that happened. And the second is Red for Ed, 84 years later. But nevertheless, I think there's some things that are similar. And then I go abroad. Brazil in the late 1970s, that was in Sao Paulo, led by Lula. There was, in effect, a general strike, which eliminated the dictatorship. And then, of course, Solidarity in Poland, which was a general strike, in effect. The unions have to, during these moments of great they transform themselves, they transcend themselves, they begin to reshape the society. That's one of the things that we think, thinking boldly, and those people who do think boldly, Sarah Nelson and Sean Fain, and Bernie for that matter, I think, you know, that's important. That's important to think boldly, you know.
Well, you're reminding me of another example, which is France in 1968,
right.
Yeah. Which started with a student strike. And yeah. that may be relevant right now, because if you are going to have the University of California has yet to be fully targeted by the way Harvard and the other private universities for removing of huge blocks of aid. But that's only a matter of time, I think. And I'm just wondering whether if you had, given that thousands of students or workers who are organized by the UAW now in California, you could actually have a process, I'm just fantasizing, in which there was the student unions led a strike against the federal efforts to destroy the universities.
As soon as they've, when they've paid off all the costs, the legal costs of the injunction on their last strike over political issues.
Well, then it wouldn't have to be. So the unions wouldn't, you know, it's not necessary to have the unions take the lead, but having you could have a student worker alliance, which is something my generation was somewhat dreaming about at times, based on, you know, this attack on the universities as part of what is generally the dictatorship that is trying to be imposed upon us. So, and that would be, it could end in some kind of general strike situation.
Well, I would say this, I about 2 months ago, there was a terrific, the UAW Local 4811, which is the grad students, researchers, et cetera, quite, you know, it represents almost 50,000 academic workers. They had at a time when the regents and the president of the university was basically saying nothing or kind of accommodating to Trump. They had a terrific presentation about the cutbacks and you know, and just what that will mean. Mm-hmm. It wasn't agitational. It wasn't saying we're going to go on strike tomorrow, but it indicated that they were taking kind of grasping this crisis and kind of understanding it in a way that the official leadership of this university was not. I thought that was very impressive. And more recently, the Faculty Association has done sort of the same thing in a way that I haven't seen it come out of the regents or the University of California.
The deans will not save us. Okay, I want to get in the last question because we're almost out of time, and I want the parting thought. So there's a kind of high profile discussion happening amongst lefty types right now about this book published and a sort of thesis that's behind it, Ezra Klein's book about abundance and the abundance economy, and then a new poll that Axios did and is framing it, I think, in an interesting way about whether the Democratic base is more interested in populism, which they define as around, you know, blaming elites, economic elites, the oligarchs, the rich, et cetera, or an abundance frame, which sort of blames red tape, bad luck, things like bad governance for the lack of progress on, you know, infrastructure improvements, new jobs, high-speed rail, more housing, et cetera. So, like, you're someone, you've done a lot of really great work about how the labor movement and the labor left, like liberalism in America, has framed the economic question, how we've talked about the economy and the role of regular people in it. Do you have any thoughts about whether there's a strategic advantage in those two frames, or a policy one, or, what do you think? Populism or abundance?
Yeah, right. good question. Very good question. I would say that, I mean, one thing we haven't talked about much is when the union movement is strong, when it can tilt the levers of political power, then what does it do? And it is in favor of, abundance is this new word that Klein has kind of brought back. But I mean, it's in favor of planning and in favor of you know, building things and all, you know, and that was true when it could do it in the 40s and other New York City public, you know, basically worker public housing. That was a whole generation. They did that quite dramatically. So I think that, you know, the union movement has been beat down and on the defensive for so long that we don't it's very hard to grasp, but when it is powerful, what it wants. I would think that Ezra Klein's idea that somehow it's just red tape, it's just regulations. They do exist. It's true. You know, it does make things more difficult in some places to do it. But I think far more it's a question of actual resources, I mean, of money. And we've become more unequal over the last 50 years. And if you really had a powerful union movement that was strong enough to change the tax code, to change the fiscal equation, where you could put trillions of dollars into reanimating the economy. And that's what, I mean, that's why I, as a social Democrat, I thought the Biden was doing that. And that was creating an environment that it made it much easier for unions to fight and grow. And that's what was going on. I mean, yeah, I mean, the governors of Tennessee and Alabama just a few years ago would blackmail industry, saying, if you unionize, we're not going to give you these incentives. Okay. Well, when Biden comes along, the incentives that he provides are 10 times greater than that, what the states could provide, these southern states. And so that kind of blackmail disappeared, evaporated, which is one reason that Volkswagen and a few other firms, you know, did in fact have a more neutral stance when it came to some of the unionization. I'm in favor. I mean, abundance just in and of itself, without other reconfigurations of power in the society, is not going to solve the problem.
Well put.
Well, I think, Daraka, whether you intended or not, and I think you did intend it, you've opened up the gate for more episodes of Talking Strategy, Making History around this particular debate that you're pointing to. And that's part of the ongoing thing that we've been tracking here, how to make the Democratic Party represent the needs of the people and of the working people in particular. We've been privileged to have our friend Nelson Lichtenstein. The book that we've been talking about somewhat is co-edited with Samir Santi. It's called Labor's Partisans, Essential Writings on the Union Movement from the 50s to Today. And we are both recommending that, Daraka and I both, not only because we're a friend of Nelson's, because it's really a good book.
Very good.
Surprisingly so.
And support dissent. You know, I forgot to mention, you know, just that was like my first internship was at Dissent Magazine.
Oh, really? Okay.
And when it was run out of Simone Plastrick's apartment.
Mm.
And it was an amazing experience.
Well, thanks to you, Nelson, and we'll certainly be talking to you over the years to come, if there are any years to come.
Inshallah.
Okay. So thank you.
Yeah, Nick. Yeah, thanks. Right. Thanks so much.
The words of this song were taken from the preamble to the Constitution of the American Miners Association, 1861, the first miners' union in the United States. 100 years later, Pete Seeger set them to a traditional Irish air. In just 4 lines, they tell us what unions stand for.
Step by step, the longest march can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly none, singly none. And by union, what we will can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill, singly none, singly none. Step by step.